So now we're going to do monetary incentives. There are, of course, non-monetary incentives, such as recognition and feedback. Now, part of this material comes from the Personnel Economics 1 course that some of you took in the winter semester, though not all. Of course, not all. It's a separate course. Now, in the course Personnel Economics 1, which some of you took in the winter semester, we learned mostly about monetary incentives when risk preferences are neutral, so people are neither risk-averse nor risk-loving. Today we're going to learn about monetary incentives when risk preferences are non-neutral. Does it make a difference? It does. It does make a difference to the design and construction of incentive scheme. Now, why we study monetary incentives? Because everything in economics is about incentives. Incentives are the essence of economics. You're not going to understand economics without understanding incentives. And on a more practical note, chances are that a large proportion of you, when you get out of university and find yourself a job, chances are a large proportion of you will actually face one type of monetary incentives or the other. Because about 40% of employees in Germany had one type of incentive pay or the other in their job as of the year 2009. This was the last year when such question was asked in the German socioeconomic panel. So incentives are practiced not everywhere, but in a number of places. So they do make a difference to people's performance in negative as well as positive way. Today we're going to be talking about positive difference to the performance that incentives make. In two lectures time, we're going to be talking about possible negative differences to performance that monetary incentives make. So stay tuned and welcome to this block of lectures. Now, so this is another illustration of how widely spread incentive pay arrangements are. Why do firms practice incentives? Well, they practice incentives in order to solve the principal agent problem. What is the principal agent problem? The principal agent problem is a problem of a conflict of interest between the principal who wants to maximize a profit and the agent who wants to maximize the wage net of the costs of effort. Now, there's clearly a conflict of interest. The agent wants to work as lightly as possible. The principal wants to maximize the profit, which implies a level of effort which is higher than the level of effort that the agent would choose if in the absence of any incentives. Now, this is very well understood and should be understood by everybody. We had, as I said, we spent a lot of time discussing various models of incentives, basically piece rates, performance-related pay, bonuses, in cases when both principal and agent are risk neutral. Now, risk neutrality is an assumption which is hard to defend in reality because most of us are actually non-risk neutral. The problem is that when people are non-risk neutral, then the maths very quickly become very difficult and that many models of incentive pay quickly become intractable, so we have to strike a balance between mathematical tractability of our theories and the realism of situations that these theories seek to describe. So in this lecture, we're going to be looking at one particular type of incentives, which is piece rates or linear incentive schemes, when you receive a certain fixed amount of money for every unit of a measure of performance that is used to evaluate your performance. The major difference between this course and Personnel Economics 1 course is that we're going to be looking at the case when people have non-risk neutral preferences. So, when we talk about risk preferences, what do we mean? What do we mean by risk preferences? Well, we mean risk neutrality, risk aversion, and risk seeking or risk loving. And the textbook definitions of risk neutrality, aversion, and risk-seeking are in front of your eyes. With some light notation, these notions can be formalized. So imagine a very simple situation. You have an investment asset. Let's not call it a lottery. You're facing a real decision. It's not frivolous. You have a lottery. You have an investment opportunity, which, if all goes well, will give you 300 euros cash. And if not all goes well, you will lose your money. Okay? So with probability 50%, you get 300 euros from it. With probability 50%, you'll get 0 euros from it. Question is, and it's a serious question, how much money would you be willing to invest into this opportunity? So for how much, what would be your maximum price that you'd be willing to pay in order to acquire access to this opportunity? And the answer to this question determines your risk preference type. Risk-loving, if you're risk-loving, then your maximum, the maximum price that you'd be willing to pay for this is 150 euros, which is exactly equal to the mathematical expectation of your income. So maximum you would pay what this investment opportunity brings you in expectation, in statistical expectation terms. So you only care about expected income and you do not care in your valuations about the uncertainty that this opportunity presents. Now, most of us would say 120, 130, 110, you know, most of us would say less, strictly less than 150. Why? Is this greediness? Yes, to some extent, but mainly it's risk aversion. Now, for risk averse people, the following inequality holds. What it means? For risk averse people, the expected value of the utility from various uncertain outcomes is strictly less than the utility of the expected value. What does it mean in plainer language? It means that you would be much happier, if you're risk averse, you would be much happier to just get 150 euros uncertainty free, right? You could win 300 or you could win zero, but you would rather have 150 for sure, right? So if there is a strict preference, this is the utility from having 150 for sure. And this is the expectation of utility of winning maybe 300 and maybe winning zero. And if it's the case, then of course, this is your expected utility from this investment opportunity. And because this expected utility is less than the utility from 150 euros in cash, your price to participate in this investment opportunity is strictly less than 150 euros. Okay? So for risk-averse people, the utility is reduced by what? By the uncertainty of the income that these people face. And if your utility is destroyed partly by the uncertainty of the income that you're facing, you would be willing to pay a premium in order to avoid this uncertainty. Or, put differently, if your job is of such nature that your income is uncertain, then you would require that your boss compensate you for the uncertainty that you're facing. So if risk is an issue for you, you would require compensation. And this is going to play a very important role. This idea is going to play a very important role in the rest of the lecture. Now, a peculiar minority of us are actually risk-seeking or risk-loving. What it means? It means that for them, the expected utility of essentially playing a lottery, 300 to 50, to zero lottery, is actually strictly greater than the utility from getting a boring 150 euros for sure. So they're actually willing to pay more in order to get the thrill of it. Okay? So lottery tickets is a classical example of risk-seeking behavior. Now, it is, does it really, you know, fully explain this behavior? No, there is a more complicated so-called prospect theory by Kahneman and Tversky, who say that depending on whether it's framed as gain or loss, the same person may exhibit risk-seeking or risk-averse behavior, most of us buy insurance and lottery tickets at the same time, which doesn't make sense from the expected utility point of view. Why does it not make sense from the expected utility point of view is a question that you are invited to address at home. But we are now in the world of expected utility, so bear with me. Risk-loving people, minority, but they exist. Now, how do I know? Here is a nice picture, very interesting picture from the paper by Thomas Doman, Armin Falk, and co-authors Uwe Zunde. I have met as well. So they had a lot of observations from people who they asked this question. They asked the same question as I asked you one slide before. Imagine you have a lottery that pays either 0 or 300 euros. How much money would you be willing to pay for this lottery? The difference was, between my question and their question, the difference was that they actually were paying money for it. So if you say, I am willing to buy this lottery for X euros, your choices would be incentivized. So, and this is a distribution. This is a distribution of people's choices. So some people would not play this lottery at all. So for them, it's so they would just zero. They would just play zero. Okay. So a lot of people would only offer 100 euros, even though the mathematical expectation of winning in the lottery is 150. So whoever offered less than 150, all these observations, all these massive observations, are they've got to be risk-averse people. Now look, some people offered 150 euros. These are risk-neutral. Some actually offered a little bit more. They are risk-loving. Right? So types of people differ in terms of risk preferences, and the majority of us, the absolute majority of us, are actually risk-averse. Now, this fact, this empirical fact, has important implications for the designs of incentive pay schemes. Now, before we get to the issue of incentive pay scheme design for non-risk-neutral agents, let us introduce additional terms that are going to feature prominently in the rest of today's lecture and in the whole of the lecture next week, which I will try not to be late for. So here is a utility function. Everybody knows what a utility function is. This is on the horizontal axis, you have the outcomes of investments. And on the vertical axis, you have the utility from these outcomes. So here's a lottery, which can give you XH, a high payoff with certain probability, or with 1 minus this probability, it will give you a low payoff, XT. Now, somewhere in the middle is the expected value of the outcome. And look, the utility from the expected value of the outcome, the utility from the expected value of the outcome, is actually higher, is actually more than the expected utility from these two outcomes. So this is the utility of the expected, and 1 minus p times this plus p times this will give you the expected utility. Now the utility function is, as you can see, concave. Now, the concavity of the utility function implies risk aversion, and risk aversion implies the concavity of the utility function. The most important term I'd like to talk about in this picture is the term called certainty equivalent. And certainty equivalent is denoted here as X star. What is a certainty equivalent? Now, certainty equivalent is the amount of money, X star, such that the utility from having this money for sure is exactly equal to the expected utility of the lottery. So to get back to my original question, how much would you be willing to buy this lottery for And some people would say 100 euros, other people would say 110 euros, other people would say 180 euros. Whatever the amount people will give, this amount will be, by definition, the certainty equivalent. The equivalent of a certain amount in cash, which they would have to pay for the privilege of getting, of playing a lottery with the following expected outcomes, right? So the certainty equivalent is, once again, is the fixed amount of money that the for the agent is equivalent to playing an uncertain lottery. Hence the name of the term, certainty equivalent. You understand? Any questions? Good. So, now, how do you specify certainty equivalent? It turns out that there's a convenient function, there's a convenient rule for specifying certainty equivalent, which holds for some utility functions with certainty and for with precision, and for other utility functions it's only an approximation. So in general, whatever your utility function is, the certainty equivalent can be expressed approximately as the following formula. It's basically certainty equivalent is equal to the average, is equal to the expected value, say 150 euros in the lottery that I mentioned, minus this thing. What is this? Well, one half is one half. R of X is the coefficient of the absolute risk aversion. It's a term in economics, which I'm sure you know about. If not, go to Wikipedia to read more about it. And the third component here is the variance of X. So for the risk-averse people, the risk aversion coefficient is positive. So therefore, for the risk-averse people, certainty equivalent is strictly less than the average. For the risk-neutral people, the certainty equivalent is exactly equal to the average, which means that the risk aversion coefficient for them is equal to zero. For the risk-loving people, the risk aversion is actually negative, so their certainty equivalent is higher than the average. So risk preferences can be summarized very compactly in terms of this coefficient of risk aversion. And having done so, you can express utility function, you can express the utility function approximately in the general case as the following linear function of risk preferences. Now, deriving this result, you're invited to derive this result as a practice question. And with a couple of hints that I've given, namely, basically, you have to take a utility function and expand it using Taylor series expansion up to the second order, then things become very easy and you can actually algebraically derive this expression. So you're invited to try it out as a practice question. But in general, this approximation holds, and this approximation is going to help us derive the maths in the next two lectures. Okay, now we're talking about a risk averse agent and a principal. Now, who is the principal? What are the principal's risk preferences? Let us assume for the lecture that the principal is risk neutral. Okay, now, so here's a risk-averse agent and the risk-neutral principal. They want to write down an incentive pay contract. They both want it because the agent wants to have the legal basis for his wage, and the principal wants to make sure that the agent puts in the amount of effort which is close to the profit-maximizing amount of effort rather than shirks all the time. They want to write down an incentive pay contract, and the issue of risk becomes very prominent in this contract. Once again, just to ensure everybody understands, for the risk-averse agent, the certainty equivalent is strictly below the average. Now, the difference between the average and the certainty equivalent is half risk aversion times the variance. Sometimes it's called risk premium. It's the amount of money that the agent is either willing to give up to avoid uncertainty or would require to receive on top of his wage in order to compensate for the extra costs of uncertainty that he bears. So this is risk premium. And the question is, how do you divide risks under an incentive contract? This is a classical problem in the economics of decision making. It comes under the heading efficient risk sharing. And before we get to the incentive pay contracts as a particular type of the incentive of the effective risk sharing problem, let us consider this problem in general. Okay, so here's a story. You have two individuals, A and B. They have incomes IA and IB coming from some sort of assets, either investments or property or employment, doesn't matter. So you have income IA, I have income IB. Both IA and IB are random incomes in a sense that on a good day I can have high income, on a bad day I can have low income. So these incomes are both random, and to make things very simple, they are independent of each other. Even though in general case you can relax this independence assumption. Now, if agents A and B are totally independent of each other, they pursue their own interests, then their certainty equivalent payoffs, using the formula from the previous slide, are specified by these equations. So the individual A's certainty equivalent from the income that he has is the expected value of this income minus half the risk aversion of agent A times the variance of agent A's income. And the same goes for agent B. Now, when they do it alone, they both are facing the costs of bearing uncertainty. Question is, can we try and reduce the costs of bearing uncertainty? And the answer is yes. And this answer has been not only theory, but also practice since about 300, if not 400 years ago, when the first insurance companies came to existence. And what is the idea of insurance companies? Why are insurance companies profitable? Because insurance companies pool risks. So it actually makes sense from the life perspective as well as from the mathematics perspectives to pool randomly varying incomes of different people into some common pool from which they will be co-financed. So that's the idea of insurance, if you like. Now, with this idea of insurance, agent A approaches agent B or vice versa, doesn't matter, and say, look, let us make a partnership. Let us form a partnership in which we will bring our incomes together and share these incomes in a certain proportion. Good idea? Well, might strike you as a, you know, strange idea. Why should I pool my income with any one of you here? But that's what actually happens under employment relationship. Because remember, under employment relationship, you have instead of a principal who needs a job to be done and an independent contractor who can provide this job on the market, you have a partnership of sorts in which the worker who does the job is now the employee working for the principal's bottom line and receives a cash transfer in exchange for the job, for the services that he delivers to the principal. So in the world of work, in the world of employment, such partnerships happen all the time and they are called employment contracts. Okay? So now you have a partnership between agent A and agent B. The question is, how should they divide the incomes from this partnership between each other? And the idea is the following. Let us bring these incomes together so we have a total income IA plus IB, and we will split this income with some weights. So agent A gets the share of alpha of his own income and the share of beta of the income earned by agent B, and agent B gets the remainder. So the share 1 minus alpha of the income by agent A and the share 1 minus beta of his own income. And there is also, to make the problem more general, there is also a possible cash transfer between B and A. So B will pay W to A. You see this cash transfer here. Now, the question is, how do we define the shares of alpha and beta in which the incomes of A and B are to be distributed between agents A and B? Well, we have to set up an expected utility maximization problem in terms of certainty equivalence. So this is the certainty equivalent, all these two lines are the certainty equivalent of the total income by agents A and B. And the question now is, how can we maximize the certainty equivalent of the sum of incomes by agents A and B with respect to the shares in which these incomes are to be distributed between agents A and B? So it's a simple maximization problem. In terms of the shares A and B, you derive the first order conditions from which you derive the optimal solutions for the shares in which the incomes of agents A and B are distributed between these agents. So, as a practice question, you're invited to go through the maths and try to arrive at this solution. Now, how does the solution look like? Now, agent A receives share of alpha of his own income and the share beta of the agent B's income, right? How large is this share? This share is equal, well, alpha and beta are equal, no wonder, because money doesn't smell, right? It doesn't matter whether it's a share of my income or a share of your income. It's both incomes are in euros. Now, so this share is determined by the following ratio. What is this ratio? Well, remember, this is the risk aversion coefficient of agent B, and this is the risk aversion coefficient of agent A, and the risk aversion coefficient of agent B. And then, you know, 1 minus alpha is just 1 minus these expressions, and that's what you get. Now, it is often convenient to express these solutions in terms of the inverse of risk aversion, which is risk tolerance. The interpretation of risk tolerance is not surprisingly inverse to the interpretation of risk aversion. So people for whom risk aversion is very small, they are very tolerant of risk, so big R is very large for them. And conversely, people for whom small r is very large, who are very, very risk averse, they have lower risk tolerance. So you can determine the optimal shares in which the income is to be distributed, either in terms of risk aversion or in terms of risk tolerance. Now, what are the implications of this result? Why it's important to appreciate this result for the purposes of our course? Now, one implication tells you that pooling incomes, bringing these incomes together and distributing them in the proportion determined by alpha and beta, is actually welfare enhancing. What does it mean? It means that the total welfare of agents A and B is actually higher when they are in partnership as opposed to when they are doing things separately. Why so? Well, let's calculate. This is the total expected utility of total certainty equivalent of the incomes of agent A and B. Expected value of income for agent A plus expected value of income for agent B minus half of the total risk aversion times the variance of the total income, right? So now, that of course you will get when you substitute the expressions for A and B in the total expected utility, which is defined here. So just take A, so just take alpha and beta, substitute them throughout. into this expression, and what you should get in the end is this expression. Now look here. If you have two risk-averse agents, A and B, both of whom are risk-averse in the sense that their risk aversion coefficients are positive, their total utility is higher than the sum of their individual utilities. Why? Because the pooling of the risks create the effect that the joint risk aversion of the partnership between A and B is actually strictly lower than either RA or RB. So by pooling the incomes together, you create basically an asset which is less risky, which is less risky than the individual assets IA and IB, which are owned individually by agents A and B. Okay, so pooling uncertain incomes is an excellent way of, is a welfare improving way of protecting yourselves from various risks. Okay, so that's implication number one, and it follows directly from the maths. Risk pooling is a great idea. Now, there is a second implication, which is, I would say, more related to our lecture. The second implication is that if you look at the maths, it will become immediately clear that it's the agent who is less risk-averse, it's this agent who should bear the larger share of the total income. Let's look at the maths. This is the optimal solutions, or this is the optimal solution of the share in the total income that should go to agent A. Suppose agent B is risk neutral, or very, very little risk averse. So agent B's risk aversion coefficient is very, very small. And agent A is risk averse. So for him, RA is not zero, right? Now, if agent B is risk neutral and agent A is risk averse, what is the implied optimal share of agent A in the total income of the partnership? What's it equal to? He gets zero, exactly. So if agent B is risk neutral and he wants to partner up with a risk averse agent, then agent B should get all the income from the partnership, and agent A should get no income from the partnership. Of course, the agent A will only do that, will only be willing to form a partnership, if agent B is going to give him a cash transfer W, which is equal to the certainty equivalent of his uncertain income. But in terms of the shares in the income generated by the partnership, it's the risk-neutral agent who should get everything, and the risk-averse agent, the risk-averse partner in the partnership, he should get nothing except the fixed wage W, except the fixed cash transfer W that the risk-neutral agent B would transfer to agent A in exchange for his part of income in the partnership, right? This is mathematically necessary implication of this partnership. What does it mean? It means if you want to share risks efficiently, the efficient risk sharing implies that the risk has to be borne more by the people who are more tolerant of it. It makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? If I don't care about risks, I should bear the risk. If I do care about risk, then optimally I should not bear risk. Why? Because if I have to bear risk, right? If I am risk averse and I have to bear risk, what's going to happen is I want a risk premium because my certainty equivalent from a risky lottery is going to be strictly less than its expected value. Okay? And somebody has to pay me this risk premium if I am to be part of the partnership. But if there's another guy who doesn't care about risk, for whom this risk premium is zero, it's only efficient that this person bears all the risk from the partnership, and the risk-averse person would get a fixed wage W, which is equal to the certainty equivalent for his original of his original income before joining the partnership, right? So the implication of this maths is that if you have a partnership between B, who is risk neutral, and A, who is risk averse, A should get a fixed cash amount and B should bear all the risks, which makes a lot of sense. You know, that's what you get in a sense when you bring your money to a bank. You could invest your money in stocks, buy some Wertpapier, right? But then you would be you would be suffering from systemic and idiosyncratic risks of the financial market. Here's a deposit account which gives you a guaranteed, insured, secured level of income, which is of course a lot less than the mathematical expectation of your income on the stock market. But then the bank takes care of all the risk that of all the financial risks that investing your money entails. So a lot of partnerships in real life work like this. Is this the case in employment, in the employment relationship? Well, if we transfer this logic from the world of financial partnerships into the world of employment relationships, the implications are not going to be very nice. Because if it's the agent risk averse, a risk neutral agent B who bears all the risk, and agent A gets fixed wage, right? Then agent A, who is in the employment relationship with agent B, has no incentive to put in any effort into the generation of income. Okay, if incomes come from, I don't know, some financial market transactions, that's fine. But if incomes are created by effort, right? The agent A, having received the fixed wage, will have no incentive to care about creating output, creating income for agent B, as long as A gets his fixed wage. So the efficient risk sharing is not going to work in the case of employment relationship. Why not? Because it implies that agents should get a fixed wage, but then if the agent gets a fixed wage, agent puts in no effort. So let's move on to the application of decisions under risk in the case of the linear incentive scheme when agent is not risk neutral. So here's the basic setup of the model. It looks almost the same as in personnel economics one, except that it's now more general. What is the generality here? So you have the principal and the agent, and they are negotiating over an incentive pay contract. The incentive pay contract is of the linear form, which means that the agent's wage is equal to some fixed amount alpha plus coefficient beta times Z. What is Z? Z is whatever measure of performance that the principal is using in order to assess the effort that the agent puts into his work. It does not have to be the output that the agent creates. The output that the agent creates is determined by some production function P of E, which right now is not extremely important, right? So it's some kind of production function. Doesn't have to be linear, can be nonlinear. But the principal uses this performance measure Z, which is just the effort plus some additive random noise eta with a known distribution, in order to learn about the level of effort that the agent has put into the work, and not only to learn, but also to determine the agent's wage from this following simple linear rule. Now, different people have different incentives. The agent wants to maximize the difference between his expected wage and the risk and the costs of risks and the costs of effort. And the principal wants to maximize the net profit, which is the output created by the agent minus the wage costs that the principal needs to pay to the agent. So just like in personnel economics one, let's look first at the agent's actions and then we will look at the principal's actions. Very, very similar treatment to the winter semester, except that now it's a little bit more general, in the sense that the agent does not have to get a fraction of the output that he creates. His wage can be based on a completely different measure of performance, but as long as his wage is linear in this measure of performance, we're in business. Now, what does the agent do? The agent, of course, maximizes the certainty equivalent of his income, and the only decision variable that the agent has is the level of effort that he chooses to put in to his work. Now, the certainty equivalent of the agent is the expected value of the wage minus the costs of effort minus this guy, which you know is called risk, the costs of risk or risk premium. So you want to maximize this expression with respect to effort. Now, when you substitute wage inside here, then the certainty equivalent of the agent's income as a function of effort becomes to be expressed by this formula. The first order condition from maximizing agent's certainty equivalent in terms of agent's effort is this. So this is the derivative of the cost of effort with respect to effort, and this is the parameter beta of the incentive scheme, which is often called the strength of incentives. So small beta means weak incentives, big beta means strong incentives. Now we can see immediately from this result, from the first order condition, from the agent's utility maximization problem. It's also called the incentive constraint in the literature, but you don't need to necessarily know this terminology. So this expression immediately has a very useful intuition. What it tells you? It tells you that the larger, the stronger are the incentives that the principal creates for the agent, the harder the agent will work. Now make sure in your preparation for this course, make sure that you understand why it's the case. Make sure that you understand that larger beta corresponds to higher effort in order to keep this first order condition satisfied. Now, in the meantime, the principal doesn't sleep. The principal knows the logic of the agent. The principal knows that the agent will choose the level of effort which corresponds to the strength of incentives that the principal will choose for him. And what the principal now wants to do, the principal wants to maximize his expected profit, which, just to remind you, is equal to the output created by the agent minus this term. Now, what is this term? This term corresponds to the wage that you need to pay to the agent if you want the agent to invest the level of effort E. What does it consist of? Well, obviously, you need to compensate for the cost of effort, and hence this C of E term here. You would also need to compensate for the risk that the agent bears as part of the incentive scheme. Again, make sure you understand why the agent bears financial risks implied by the linear incentive function. And finally, the third and least interesting component here is just the constant U bar, which is called the agent's reservation utility, which is the utility expressed in monetary terms from basically doing nothing, right? So this is the costs that need to be compensated to the agent for bearing risks and putting in effort. In addition, the agent requires a compensation for the next best available opportunity, which is the utility that the agent gets from not working, right? From enjoying the nice weather on Bodensee. So this allows to express the principal's profit in terms of the optimal, in terms of the optimal effort choice by the agent. Okay? So in other words, this is the principal's profit. It depends positively on the agent's effort, because the harder the agent works, the more output he creates. But this relationship is not monotonic, because also the harder the agent works, the higher the costs of effort he bears, which need to be compensated. And also, the harder the agent works, the larger is the risk premium that he requires. So the choice of effort that the principal would find optimal is a trade-off between the productivity of the agent's effort and the costs of this effort. And the costs of the effort consist of two parts, the costs of effort itself plus the implied costs of bearing risk. Now, maximizing the principal's profit expressed as a function of the agent's effort leads to the following first-order condition, solving which determines the optimal strength of incentives that the principal will choose to implement for the agent. So it depends positively, as you can see, it depends positively on the agent's productivity. The larger is this marginal product of agent's effort, the stronger the optimal incentives should be. Makes sense, right? The more valuable the agent's effort is, the more of it you want to see. Now, the strength of incentives depends negatively on the second derivative of the agent's cost of effort. The second derivative of the agent's cost of effort basically tells you how convex the agent's costs function is. In other words, how quickly how strongly the agent's costs of effort increase with effort. If this term is small, then the denominator in this expression is small, which means that the incentives have to be really strong. But if the agent gets very tired very quickly, this term becomes very large, and that means that you shouldn't incentivize the agents too strongly, because if you incentivize them too strongly, they will work like hell, but because they will work like hell, their cost of effort is going to be very large, and your total profits are not going to be very large. Now, the strength of incentives depends also negatively on the sigma squared. What is sigma squared? Sigma squared is the variance of the random additive noise in the measure of the agent's performance. Just to refresh your memory, this is the measure of performance that the principal uses to reward the agent. It has the term eta. Eta follows normal distribution with zero mean and variance equals sigma squared. So that's where it comes. Now, in other words, the noisier is the measure of performance that the principal uses to reward the agent. The larger the sigma squared is going to be, the larger is the sigma squared, the less the strength of incentives should be. Why? Question for self-practice. And finally, the strength of incentives depends negatively on the risk aversion coefficient. In other words, more risk-averse people should optimally be given less strong incentives. And if you are risk-neutral, you are really a gift to your firm, because it means that you can be incentivized very, very strongly, because then this term just goes away and your strength of incentives is equal to the marginal product of your effort, which point corresponds to the welfare maximization, to the level of effort which maximizes the total welfare. But it's a different story. Now, so how do you determine the pair of optimal effort and the optimal strength of incentives? You determine these two quantities from the incentive constraint and the rule for the optimal strength of incentives. These are two equations in terms of two variables which, under some very general circumstances, have a unique solution. There will be a tutorial on incentives where you can go through the maths once again and solve some elementary problems on incentives. One such elementary problem is given here. It's just an example. Imagine a very simple case. Your output is just equal to your effort. There's a linear transformation between effort and output. Then you just substitute this function into the formula for the optimal strength of incentives and get these results. Also assume that the costs of effort are quadratic in effort, substituting the costs of effort into the formula for optimal strength of incentives, and the incentive constraint gives you the optimal beta as a function of costs of effort, uncertainty of the environment, and the risk preferences of the agent. The fixed wage is also determined from the participation constraint, the optimal effort, the principal's profit, and so on and so on and so on. So once you specify the parameters of the technology and costs of effort and parameters of the environment, which is characterized by uncertainty with a certain variance sigma squared, the optimal incentives problem has a very well-defined and a very well-known solution. What does this solution imply for the level of effort that the worker, the agent, will choose to exert under a given linear incentive scheme? Well, very clearly, if you offer no incentive pay, so your wage is fixed, just like in the efficient risk-sharing problem, the agent gets a fixed wage, but if the agent gets the fixed wage, if beta is equal to zero, right? If beta is equal to zero, then the incentive constraint implies that the optimal level of effort is also going to be zero, because the marginal costs are equal to zero only when the effort is equal to zero. Of course, you know, you could say, oh, Nick, come on, not everybody is getting incentive pay. Some people exert some non-zero level of effort for a fixed wage. Yes, I agree. It means that you use other means to incentivize effort, such as, for instance, monitoring. If you have a monitoring in place, then with monitoring, you can actually control for a certain necessary level of effort required to produce a certain amount of output. At least, for instance, you can control for when your worker came to work. You can control whether they work the required number of hours. This is very easily verifiable. Of course, it doesn't tell you the full picture, but at least it provides you some minimum level of control in order to elicit some non-zero level of effort, even without incentives. In which case, we have a corner solution, which is not very interesting. A story is much more interesting, just, you know, without the corner solution, when we see that the amount of effort increases proportionately, positively, with the strength of incentives offered by the principal to the agent. This is the so-called incentive effect, right? What it means when you introduce incentives, everybody starts working harder, and because everybody is working harder, the total output of the firm will increase. So incentives, when they work, they really do great things to your performance. Do practice incentives, but practice them in the right way. Now, there is a second effect which incentives create, which is relevant to firm performance, the so-called sorting effect. How does it work? It works in the following way. Let's look at our example. Very simple example. What it says? Given the strength of incentives, the strength of incentives is determined as a function of risk aversion, costs of effort, and the uncertainty of the environment. Now, you cannot do anything with the uncertainty of the environment, but what you can do is you can change the costs of effort parameters and the risk aversion parameters of your workforce by hiring people with lower costs of effort and with lower risk aversion, right? So if you introduce a certain incentive scheme with non-zero strength of incentives, then some people are going to like it. Who are going to be the people? Who will be the people who are going to like incentives? Will they have low or high costs of effort? Will they have low or high risk aversion? Yeah? Exactly. Because these people actually like incentives. For them, incentives are good. And given the incentives, they're going to work harder because, look, their effort negatively depends on their costs of effort and on their risk aversion, right? So these people with low risk aversion and low costs of effort are going to work hard and they're going to get lots of money. Now, suppose you have people with very high risk aversion, very high costs of effort. For them, it's not going to be a very good deal at all, because their effort is going to be low, and if their effort is low, then their total wage is also going to be low. So they will be looking out for other opportunities outside the organization. So the people with high delta and high R will be more likely to leave. The people with low delta and low R will be more likely to stay. And moreover, the people from outside the organization with low risk aversion and low cost of effort will be more likely to come and replace the lazy and risk averse workers who will be more likely to leave as a result of the introduction of incentive pay. So this is the essence of the selection effect. Not only do incentives increase the effort levels of the existing workers, they also affect the distribution of risk aversion and cost of effort parameters in your current workforce by basically prompting high risk aversion, high cost of effort people to leave and inviting low risk aversion, low cost of effort and as people to come. And as a result, of course, you will have a better, more productive, less risk averse workforce who will work harder, and the total effort and profits of the organization will increase. So these are the two, if you like, mechanisms through which incentive pay becomes relevant not only to managing personnel, but more broadly to the well-being, economic well-being of organizations, of an organization as a whole. Now, so this is theory, and it's very nice. The question is, does it make sense in reality, right? Do incentives work in practice? And the answer to this question is they very much work in practice. Incentives are a great thing to practice. Here's a very famous paper by Edward Lazier, Performance, Pay, and Productivity. It's a classical paper. Whatever textbook you read on personnel economics, this work will be mentioned there. It reports the results of an experiment in which a firm named Safelite Glass Corporation gradually implemented incentives and replaced their existing fixed wage arrangements with the newly designed incentive pay scheme. As a result of the introduction of incentive pay, the productivity at Safelite Glass Corporation went up by an improbable 44%. Half of this effect is due to existing workers working harder, that is the incentive effect, and half of it is due to new workers coming to replace the old workers being more productive and less risk averse. So there's both selection and incentive effects of incentive pay. Now, it turns out that Safelite Glass Corporation, in a few years' time after the introduction of incentive pay, it actually went bankrupt. And people ask questions about, do incentives really work? The answer to this question is emphatically yes, incentives do work. You just have to make sure that you incentivize the right sorts of behavior. And we will see how important it is in two lectures' time from now. In one lecture's time from now when we talk about negative consequences of incentives. So incentives is a very powerful weapon, but you really need to be very good at personnel economics to try and understand how they optimally work. Well, speaking of which, if incentives are so great in theory and there is some corroborative empirical evidence, why do we see that some firms practice incentives and other firms don't practice incentives? You could say, well, it's because some firms are headed by managers who attended Nick's lectures on incentives and other firms are headed by managers who don't understand incentives. That would be a very naive answer to the question. So, because to the extent to which firms don't do what's right, to the extent to which firms don't implement the best people management practices that they can have, these firms will be performing less well than their competitors and will eventually be taken over by more productive, more operationally efficient rivals. What you see, in fact, is that, well, equally well-performing, equally intelligently managed firms sometimes practice incentives, other times don't. So the question is, why aren't incentives practiced to the same extent by different firms? Well, there are several reasons, and we're going to mention some of these reasons in the remainder of this lecture. The first reason is that incentives are the so-called second best solution to the principal agent problem. I take it that you understand the term second best. If not, you can read up on it. It basically means, very shortly, it means not welfare maximizing. And the intuition here is very simple. Take the case of linear incentives. Under linear incentives, beta, optimal beta, is not zero. If the optimal beta is not zero, the agent bears some financial risk, which is expensive for the agent to bear, more expensive for the agent to bear than for the principal. That reduces welfare and makes linear incentive the second best arrangement. So, another reason is that the efficiency of incentives is compromised, is severely reduced by the precision with which you measure performance. Look here. Optimal incentives depend negatively on the noise in your performance measure. If your performance measure is very noisy, this guy is going to be very high. If sigma squared is going to be very high, the strength of incentives is going to be very low. If the strength of incentives is very low, the effort is also very low, so the economic effect of incentives is going to be very, very low. If the uncertainty, the noise with which you measure people's performance, which is relevant for incentives, is very high. And in many situations, it is indeed the case. In many situations, it's very hard to measure performance. Think about, for instance, quality. How do you measure quality? Very uncertain measure. Another reason why not every organization practices incentives is because when you do want to do incentives and you don't have good measures of performance, you can actually use what you believe is good measures of performance, but these measures of performance are not going to be related to performance at all. So that invites the so-called dysfunctional behavioral responses to poorly designed incentives. And we're going to look at these dysfunctional behavioral responses in 2 weeks' time from now. And finally, there may be an issue of fit, of alignment between incentives as a one particular HR practice and the entire HR strategy as a whole, which should also dovetail into the business strategy of the entire organization. If you want to learn more about strategic HR management and the role of incentives in strategic HR management, take a few HR courses or come to my compensation and benefits course, which is also taught in this semester, where we look at the issues of strategic fit. So there are a variety of reasons, and we're going to concentrate on some of the factors affecting the likelihood of observing incentive pay policies in real firms. These factors are size of the firm, risk or loss aversion of the workers, uncertainty of output, dysfunctional behavioral responses, the topic of a lecture in the future, and the issue of strategic fit. One particular issue here, one particular example, is when you want to do individual incentives discourage cooperation, obviously, because you are only incentivized for the output for your individual measure of performance rather than the group measure of performance. If you want to solve this problem by basing incentives on some team-based measure of performance, then the problem is free riding. Also a known problem from Personnel Economics 1 course. So, of course, you can practice incentives in the contexts which are likely to be dominated by reputational concerns and peer pressure, which will shape the performance response to given incentives in its own weird way. But the story will become too complicated for the purposes of the lecture today, even though we will talk about peer pressure and reputations in several weeks from now. So let's look at how these factors affecting the occurrence of incentive pay in real firms, let's see how these factors operate in reality. Let's start with firm size. Here's a nice picture from a paper by Alex Bryson and colleagues who combine lots of international data between different countries, lots of statistics of the like of the prevalence of incentive pay in different countries, different years, and different industries. Here is a picture that shows a correlation between the share of small firms in an economy and the likelihood, the percentage of firms in the respective economy that practice incentive pay. So what we see here, we see, well, a loose correlation, a loose negative correlation. We see that in the countries where the share of small firms is not very large, incentive pay is more likely, on average, of course, there are exceptions, but on average, in the countries with a smaller share of small firms, incentive pay is more likely than in countries where small firms are the backbone and the most popular, the most important firm in the economy. So in the economies where with many small firms, incentive pay is practiced less often than in the economies with larger firms. Why? What has firm size to do with whether or not you want to practice incentive pay? Well, consider, why do you need incentive pay? You need incentive pay in order to solve the principal agent problem. The principal agent problem is that the agent does not put in the required amount of effort. Now, how can this problem be solved other than by way of incentives? It can be solved by monitoring, right? And firms do monitoring. Look at these video cameras, look at these recording machines to record the time when you come to work and when you leave the work. Look at various records that your online activity generates. There are ways to monitor your effort. And it turns out that in smaller firms, it's easier to monitor effort than in larger firms. Imagine you're a small firm, you only have one office, there is a boss, there are employees, the boss can see what employees are doing, so monitoring is actually, even though not perfect, but very, very good. If you can monitor effort, why do you need to practice incentives? You can, with good possibilities to monitor effort, you can write down contracts which are not going to be based on some spurious measure of performance. There will be a contract which stipulates exactly what you need to do for how much money. And that's, of course, not incentive pay contracts. These are the regular fixed wage employment contracts. And they are more prevalent in countries where firm size is small. Now, if you have a large firm, it's increasingly harder to monitor what your employees are doing. It's increasingly more expensive. So if you cannot monitor people's effort, what you have recourse to is incentives in the form of performance pay, even though there are maybe other options such as efficiency wage, for instance, which we will look at soon. Now, risk aversion, well, very simple story. Look at the optimal strengths of incentives formula. It depends on risk aversion in a negative way. More risk-averse individuals, for more risk-averse individuals, the incentives have to be less strong. If the incentives are less strong, the effort generated by these incentives is going to be less high, is going to be low. And if the effort generated by weak incentives given to the super risk-averse people are so feeble, what's the point of practicing these incentives at all? So, the logical implication is that in the environments in which you have relatively risk-averse people, there will be relatively less incentive pay. And in the environments in which you have relatively more risk-neutral or risk-loving people, there will be relatively more incentive pay. Okay? So if you come to a firm in which everybody is super risk-averse, well, I am very risk-averse, for example, right? Then you should think twice about whether you want to practice incentive pay there or not. You could still practice incentive pay, in which case I will leave due to the selection effect of incentives. But if I'm a super productive worker and if I have lots of human capital, which is very specific to the firm, which is very often the case, you will think twice about whether to introduce incentives and see me go, or not introduce incentives and continue to benefit from the skills, productivity, and human capital that I have to offer. How do we know this? Well, we know this from observations. We know that there's a correlation between people's preference for risk and the likelihood that these people will be working under incentive pay. Here's a very interesting, very short paper by Charles Bellmar and Bruce Shearer in Economics Letters. Very, very simple story. I really enjoyed reading this paper. They looked at workers in Vancouver in Canada who planted trees on the streets. So these guys had very simple job. They had saplings of trees, and for every planted tree, they would receive a certain amount of money. So this is piece rate. So this is incentive pay. They didn't have fixed wage. Their wage depended on the number of trees that they would plant. Is there uncertainty? Yes, because sometimes the soil is soft and you can plant lots of trees on a given street. Other times the soil is really stony and you really need to work very hard in order to plant your trees. So there is some uncertainty in output, and these guys were bearing some financial risk from receiving a certain piece rate for every tree that they would plant. Now guess what? They looked specifically at the tree planters and they ran a little risk aversion test with them. So basically they asked them some incentivized questions about how risky do you think your decisions are. And 46% of tree planters in Vancouver said that they are risk neutral. 46% said, I don't care about risk. I only care about expected return. Now compare this 46% with the data from Doman, Falk, Huffman, and Zunde. Remember this? How many people, what is the percentage of people who are risk neutral in here? Well, these are the people who offer 150 as a prize for the lottery, and these people make up about 10% of the population. The majority of the population are actually risk averse, and the very small minority of the people to the right from 150 are actually risk loving. Now, going back to Bellmar and Shearer, what you see here is quite the opposite. 46%, nearly a half, are risk neutral. 39% are actually risk loving, so they enjoy risk. And a very, very small minority of these guys are risk averse. What they are doing in tree planting is not clear, is not consistent with the theory, right? But if you compare these statistics with the Canada average, right, in the general population of Canada, only 16% are risk neutral or risk loving. So we're talking about a huge overrepresentation of risk neutral and risk loving people in incentive pay jobs such as tree planting. There are similar results using German socioeconomic panel, by the way, although not as strong as in Bellmar and Shearer. The bottom line is the following. Incentives require exposure to financial risk. Financial risk is cheaper to bear by people who are risk neutral. So you will have more risk neutral people in incentive pay job, and you will be more likely to introduce incentive pay arrangements in the environment where there are lots of risk neutral people. If it's not the case, if you have a bunch of risk-averse workers, you will be less likely, you'll be more constrained in your choice of incentives. Now, output uncertainty. There is, the theory says, the optimal strength of incentives, once again, depends negatively on the uncertainty with which people measure output, right? So larger uncertainty means less incentives, means lower effort, means lower likelihood of practicing incentive pay. Now, admittedly, this prediction is sort of hard to test. What Bryson and colleagues managed to do is they basically regressed the frequency of incentive pay on the economic uncertainty in the country, and they found virtually no correlation. Question is why? You have a theory which implies that there will be less incentive pay in less stable environments, more incentive pay in more stable environments. In reality, you don't see a lot of correlation. Well, one prosaic answer could be that they don't use the right measure of uncertainty of the environment. They really should use firm-specific rather than macroeconomic measure. That's one reason. But, you know, can we take this in good faith and try to connect it to our theory of incentive that we discussed earlier on today? There is a famous paper by Kenneth Prendergast, who is a very famous economist at the University of Chicago. Do read it when you have a chance. The paper is called The Tenuous Trade-Off Between Risk and Incentives. You know what the word tenuous means? It means hard, right? Difficult. There's a difficult trade-off between risk and incentives. On the one hand, more risk means less incentives through this optimal strength of incentive rules. On the other hand, when you have very little risk, it questions the need to have incentives. Imagine a highly stylized situation in which you have two firms, A and B. Firm A operates in a very stable environment, and in this environment, it can find the measure of the worker performance, which will be a very precise measure of the worker performance. So the variance of eta will be very, very low, let's say zero. Okay? So when you have a measure of performance which tells you very precisely about the effort level of the worker, this is firm A. Now firm B operates in a volatile environment. Its environment is turbulent. It's hard to come up with a measure of performance, with the observable measure of performance that will be a precise enough signal of the worker's effort. So the sigma squared in the case of firm B is very large. The sigma squared in the case of firm A is zero. Question is, which firm will be more likely to practice incentive pay? One naive logic would say, well, of course, it's firm A that's going to practice incentives, because that's precisely the environment where incentives can be designed in the strongest way possible. Whereas in the case of firm B, when the environment is volatile, sigma squared is high, incentives are weaker, and maybe not all firms will be doing incentives in this environment. Well, it turns out in empirics are much more complicated than this. It turns out that as you have seen already, there's no correlation. Why? Because there are two forces that affect whether firms implement incentives or not. One force comes from this optimal incentives rule. More stable environment give you better measure of performance and give you the possibility of offering strong incentives. But then there's a second force. The second force is, well, if you have a stable environment, why do you need incentives? If you have a stable environment, surely you could draw an employment contract in which there would be a fixed wage paid for a specified level of performance that the worker is expected. Such contract is feasible in stable environments where good performance measures are available. It's less feasible in volatile environments where no such good performance measures are to be found. So whether or not a firm practices incentive pay depends not only on how volatile the environment is, it also depends on the relative attractiveness of other ways of motivating people. Incentives is only one of such ways. So when in extremely stable environments where sigma squared practically zero, you may not practice incentives, you may practice something else. You may practice a wage contract that in which a fixed wage will be paid in exchange for a certain level of performance. And this is going to be, it may be actually welfare enhancing as opposed to incentive pay, because it does not expose the worker to financial risk, however little this risk is. Whereas if you move up the volatility scale, from very stable to more volatile environments. In these volatile environments, writing a fixed wage contract based on very observable measure of performance becomes less and less feasible, so you need to use incentive pay in order to motivate the worker. Yes, you can't use very strong incentives because sigma squared is high, but you have to use incentives because you have no other choice. Now, move from these mildly volatile environments to very volatile environments. What you're going to observe? Well, what you're going to observe is in these very, very volatile environments, the sigma squared is so super high that your optimal strength of incentives is very, very low, and incentives don't make, practicing incentive doesn't make sense. The corollary, the conclusion from this logic is that rather than seeing a negative relationship between likelihood of incentive pay and volatility of the environment, what you should see is a U-shaped relationship. Inverted, I mean, U-shaped relationship. Super stable environments, little incentive pay. Mildly volatile environments, more incentive pay. Very volatile environments, also very little incentive pay. But yet, as of yet, I don't think we know what the data say in this respect. It's just, it remains a theoretical idea which explains the empirical facts that we know right now. The last thing I have to say in today's lecture, and that's where we will stop, is a few reflections on the optimality of linear incentive scheme. Is linear incentive scheme optimal or not? The short answer is no. Why not? Well, because, as we mentioned before, when you have a risk-neutral principle sharing uncertainty with risk-averse agent, it's the principal who has to bear all the risk. If the principal bears all the risk, there are no incentives to the agent, the principal doesn't like it, and make the agent bear some of the risk through the strength of incentives beta. But when the agent bears this risk, what happens is the agent will require a compensation, the risk premium, which would not have had to be paid if the principal had borne all the risks. So you have a trade-off between economic efficiency, which dictates that principal should bear all risks, and the necessity to incentivize the agent's effort in the presence of the principal-agent problem. And this trade-off implies that the agent will be incentivized to some extent, and to the corresponding extent, the agent's income will be exposed to risk for which the agent will require a compensation. Now, the risk premium that the principal has to pay to the agent is obviously welfare reducing because it could have been avoided. But there we are. So the bottom line is linear incentive pay schemes are not fully efficient. They are second best. There's a more efficient arrangement in which the principal would just get all the income and the agent would get a fixed wage. But this arrangement is not feasible because the agent will then shirk and no output will be created. But it's okay. We live in a world of second bests, second best contracts. We can try to improve the efficiency of these contracts, but the efficiency of contracts, basically a lot of contracts, not only incentive pay, can never be brought to its maximum possible level. So that's it for today. Next week we will be going through the rest of these lecture slides, and we will be concentrating on the issues related to performance measurement for the purposes of administering performance pay. Thanks for your attention. Sorry for being late, and have a good evening.